survivors of sexual assault will be able to know that action is being taken on their kits.
A new state system lets assault survivors track the evidence kits used in their cases. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Thanks to Wesley Early for filling in last week. Also tonight, as salmon disappear from the Yukon River, a program connects families with sockeye from Bristol Bay.
That's the native way. If you can't catch it, somebody else can catch it and give it to you, you know, and your family, your friends, your relatives.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
Alaska's largest city has broken its record for outdoor deaths. So far this year, 29 people believed to be homeless have died outside in Anchorage. That surpasses last year's grim milestone of 24 outdoor deaths, and there are still 5 months left in the year. The numbers come from reporting by the Anchorage Daily News and ADN reporter Michelle Terrio-Boots, who writes about the city's homelessness issues. Terrio-Boots says 6 of the deaths happened in just a 4-day period from July 18th to the 21st, and that more than half occurred after the city closed the Sullivan Arena shelter.
That really says something. Why is this happening? I think we have incomplete information. You know, a little bit about the data. This is something that we have requested for years from the Anchorage Police Department. And what they give us is incident reports. You know, police were called to the scene of at X place and found a person not breathing, few details. And it notably does not include the cause of death. I mean, one kind of speculative explanation offered by Alexis Johnson, the homeless coordinator for the city, is that this summer you just have a bunch of people who otherwise might have been in some kind of shelter who are all camping. So in many of these recent cases, you know, people are found dead in a tent that's hidden away in the woods somewhere. So there was kind of a thought that maybe people are more isolated and there's fewer opportunities for intervention. Like no one can give you Narcan if you're alone in a tent, whereas maybe if you're overdosing in a shelter environment or somewhere where there are more people, there might be more of an opportunity for someone to intervene.
Yeah. And the city continues to work on that, but it does sound like there is not going to be anything here in the very near term in regards to a homeless shelter or navigation center. Going into the fall and winter, what do you expect to happen?
Well, I mean, there also is the threshold where the city, I think, legally has to provide some kind of cold weather shelter. What I was hearing was that the city believes that with all the new non-congregate housing that's come online recently, with the hotels that are converted to, you know, so people can live in the rooms, many people see it as a success story. They think that's going to make a really big dent in the number of people who need shelter this winter. And they think that city homeless coordinator Alexis Johnson said is they think they can handle the need for winter shelter using the non-congregate space, those hotel conversions. Whether that's true remains to be seen. And that also doesn't exactly address the issue of the person who is, you know, functioning maybe on a really low level on the street and who needs immediate, just a place to get warm on a frigid day. So I think that that's something that people believe needs to be addressed.
Well, this high number of outdoor deaths is obviously troubling, but you also recently wrote a story about somebody's journey from homelessness to getting housing. And I think it's fair to say that it's a little bit more complicated than just somebody getting a job and getting an apartment. And that person, her name is Monique. Can you tell me about her story? And I guess maybe just starting with how you met her.
Yeah. Monique, she was raised in Anchorage, went to high school in Anchorage, spent some time outside in San Diego, trained as a medical billing and coding specialist, and then found herself homeless in Anchorage about 8 years ago for the first time. You know, homelessness was kind of driven by alcoholism and some mental health issues. Monique is a really smart, really funny, witty person. And we actually met her on the steps of the Sullivan Arena the day that it closed for the summer in 2022. So about a little over a year ago. And she was one of the folks that was just sitting there like waiting for what was next. She had nowhere to go. She'd been kicked out of most of the shelters in Anchorage for what she described as her outbursts of anger. And she was just very articulate about her situation. She did not want to go camp, but that was her only choice. So the city sent her to Centennial Campground, and she went from being, you know, having all of her belongings in garbage bags at the closed Sullivan Arena to moving into an apartment. And, you know, through that time, she really worked on herself. I mean, she is completely responsible for her success. She addressed a lot of longstanding difficult issues, but she was also really helped by being able to live at a place called Complex Care, which is a small shelter for people with medically complex situations. And that place just really worked for her.
In a photo that you took, she was sitting there on her bed with her cat under her arm.
Yes, her cat, Coco, was a really big motivator. You know, as someone she knew had been caring for Coco for years, and she just wanted to be reunited with her cat and have that freedom and dignity to have a pet, which I think a lot of people take for granted. But when you're homeless, that's, you know, that's not something you can always do. And so just having that autonomy to have her pet with her meant the world to her, I think.
That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Michelle Theriault-Boots. You can find her reporting on homelessness issues and that photo of Monique in her apartment with her cat, Coco, at ADN.com. The Alaska Department of Public Safety has launched a new system that will let survivors track evidence kits used in their sexual assault cases. The goal is to assure survivors that something is being done. Jennifer Brown with Standing Together Against Rape, Inc., or STAR, a sexual assault support and prevention organization in Anchorage, says the system is a long time coming.
Survivors of sexual assault will be able to know that action is being taken on their kits.
The new system comes after the state finally cleared a years-long backlog of untested kits, and it comes after years of problems with collecting evidence and investigating sexual assault cases in Alaska. Brown says the new tracking process begins when survivors first get examined. They're given a card with a code that corresponds to a testing kit, and a nurse or advocate can help them set up an online account. Brown says the process is like tracking a package. The initial clinic has 7 days to send the kit out, then law enforcement has 30 days to process it. Last, it goes to the state crime lab.
And now the limitations on those kits being tested is a maximum of 6 months, but we're seeing that they're being tested a lot faster than that.
The tracking system launched in June. According to the Department of Public Safety, 48 kits had been logged into the system as of last week, and 33 survivors had used the system to track their status. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bethel residents show off their vehicles at the community's first car show, each with their own story.
The funny thing was is that it was actually cheaper to ship from Australia to America than it was to ship from Anchorage to Bethel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Firefighters worked to knock down a new wildfire southeast of Fairbanks over the weekend. Lily Coyle, a spokesperson for the Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, says the Mosquito Creek fire started about 5 miles east of Harding Lake Saturday night.
We're able to complete multiple bucket drops and have smoke jumpers put in and start working to contain it and get hose layer on the fire and keep it from affecting the Harding Lake area.
Also in the area, the McCoy Creek fire is over 1,000 acres. The Fairbanks North Star Borough issued evacuation notices Friday for McCoy Creek and the Lower Salcha River. The Denali Borough issued notices over the weekend for two areas threatened by a group of five wildfires in the Anderson area west of the park's highway. Last week, tens of thousands of lightning strikes sparked over 100 new fires that burned nearly 40,000 acres. Coyle says moderating weather over the weekend enabled response agencies to regroup.
Bring in additional resources into the region, you know, both from the lower 48 and from other areas in the state. We just had three hotshot crews arrive. We have additional aircraft that's coming in. We have additional support personnel coming in. And so the area is getting staffed up a lot better.
Bureau of Land Management Alaska Fire Service spokesperson Beth Ipson says weather conditions this week could result in holdover fires from past days' lightning strikes. While Bristol Bay has enjoyed a massive sockeye run in recent years, Yukon villages are facing another summer without a subsistence salmon harvest as chum and chinook returns on the river continue to dwindle. Denali Chase Hodgson grew up between both watersheds, and for the second year in a row, they're on a mission to connect Yukon families with the salmon that is disappearing from their waters. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George has more.
One day last fall, Denali Chase Hodgson returned to Anvik, a Yukon River village of less than 100 people, home to the Degaton Athabascan people. Anvik is quieter now than Hodgson remembers from visits as a kid, but that day there was a commotion.
I heard a banging coming from down the road, and I was like, what the heck? I wonder what that is. And one of my aunts, she had two of the men from our village. She was sitting out in her yard, and they were taking down her smokehouse.
Hodgson is a commercial fisherman with roots in both Anvik and South Naknek. They're part of a drift boat crew that fishes Bristol Bay, which, in contrast to the Yukon, has seen record-breaking sockeye runs in recent years. On that trip last year, Hodgson had come home with donated fish from Bristol Bay, with plans to distribute it to the community in Anvik.
I said, well, we're bringing in fish. There's fish on the way. She's like, oh, well, we're taking down our smokehouse right now. We don't really need it. You know, and that, it just absolutely broke my heart and was so devastating.
Hodgson is on a mission to reconnect Yukon villages with salmon, starting with Anvik, where their mother is from. Their vision is to support Indigenous communities' access to their traditional foods through their traditional economy of gifting and trading. For more than a decade, Yukon salmon, a critical source of food on the river, have been disappearing. This is the fourth year subsistence fishing has been closed or severely restricted. It's a threat to food security, especially in rural villages where grocery store prices can be more than twice what they are in Anchorage. For now, Hodgson, along with organizations like the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association and Tanana Chiefs Conference, are trying to fill that gap with salmon from healthier runs elsewhere in the state. For Indigenous people along the river, losing access to salmon fishing means losing a way of life. Hodgson says the fish are core to their people's identity.
The Degaton, Dene, Degaton, Athabascan people were and are inherently tied to the life of salmon. When you're looking at our language system, the months of our calendar are tied to when each one of those different species of salmon are coming up the river.
As a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, Hodgson thinks a lot about how to return Alaska's resources, especially its salmon, to Indigenous people. They partnered with fellow climate justice advocate Ruth Miller to work on native food sovereignty issues. And in June, they named their collaboration the Smokehouse Collective. Miller says the name is a symbol of community.
Because a smokehouse is a fundamental central part of so many of our cultures that brings people together. The smell of the smoke, the image of your bright red fish hanging.
Last year, partnering with the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association, they delivered 1,000 pounds of Bristol Bay salmon to Anvik. Ken Chase, an elder from Anvik, says last year's fish delivery was a big deal to the community.
It was good that people are still talking about it. And yeah, I had some of that fish. It's not the fish that we have, you know, the summer chum, but it was fish. It was something that we put in our freezers.
It's not a perfect replacement. Chase says there's something lost in not being able to pull fish out of the water and process it yourself. But the ability to share resources across the state is valuable.
That's the native way. If you can't catch it, somebody else can catch it and give it to you, you know, and your family, your friends, your relatives.
This year, Hodgson says complications with the low fish prices set by Bristol Bay processors, which fishermen have been protesting this summer, made it hard to secure sockeye to bring north. Cohos are expected to run soon, and Hodgson is hopeful there will be an opportunity to set aside some of those fish to donate. Cohos are expected to run soon, and Hodgson is hopeful there will be an opportunity to set aside some of those fish to donate. Still, Hodgson and Miller are playing the long game. They're fundraising to purchase their own drift net permit next year and buy freezer and processing space to increase their donation capacity. Hodgson says in the face of massive environmental uncertainty on the Yukon and concerns about overfishing and bycatch in the commercial fishing industry, their goal is to build sustainable, resilient food systems for Native people.
This project is a climate adaptation strategy because we are beginning to tangibly rebuild the relationships between regions and reinvigorate a network of whether it is gifting or trade that will help us to face the coming storms.
Today, their focus is the Yukon, but Hodgson hopes resource sharing networks will benefit all of Alaska as climate change continues to threaten its food systems. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Police shot and killed a black bear that charged people in East Anchorage last night after state officials say poorly stored garbage drew it to the neighborhood. Fish and game biologist Dave Battle says the man who first reported the bear on Fox Hall Drive to police was one of the people it charged.
And he actually had a firearm on him and was very close to pulling the trigger when the bear stopped. It pulled up short on its charge, but he thought he was going to have to shoot it.
Police said in a statement that the bear was extremely agitated. An officer killed the bear just before 10 p.m. Battle says the male bear weighed more than 400 pounds and is one of the biggest he's ever seen in town. He says it got that big by eating unsecured garbage in the area. Sunday's bear was the 16th killed in Anchorage so far this year. The tally includes bears killed by people defending their lives and property, as well as bears killed by police, park rangers, and wildlife officials. Last year, a total of 20 bears were killed. Battle urges residents to store garbage indoors or in secured containers to help reduce bear encounters.
The biggest thing around town is just secure your trash. Don't wait for a bear to get into it before you secure your trash. Just go ahead and secure it.
Also, he says residents should take down bird feeders in the summer and fall.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Cedar bark roses are a traditional First Nations craft in the Pacific Northwest, including for Lingit people. Soaked strips of cedar bark are folded into golden roses, which dry stiff and light. As part of a community reporting project on wellness, Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra talked to Frank Hughes in Cake, a village in southeast Alaska. He and his wife have made thousands of roses over the years, and he's discovered that for him, they have a unique healing effect.
My name is Frank Hughes. I'm retired. I'm Tlingit and Aleut, Eagle Clan, Killerwhale, Odokoedi. I've been here in Cake since May of 1986. I served in the Army in 1975 to 1983. I'm a disabled veteran, service-connected hearing loss, ringing in my ears. That's constant. It don't go away. And it bothers me sometimes because I'm hearing it all the time. And it affects who I am because I struggle with hearing. People are talking to me and I can't hear it, what they're trying to say, especially if they're behind me. We harvest the bark off the tree. There's red cedar and yellow cedar. We use what's available. Usually the wife gets the good stuff and I get the leftover stuff. And I think that's just my nature. But I make stuff out of it. Probably 2010, the wife and I were making roses. We're going to sell them to the tourists just to keep us busy. And then all of a sudden, I'm sitting in my chair. I can oversee the water. And then as I started making the rose, I started saying, there it goes. I said something to that effect. It's gone. And she said, what? I said, the ringing in my ears. It stopped. And then I started picking it back up again. And I said to myself, I'm saying this. This is nice. This is really nice. So I set it down, pick up another one like that. And all of a sudden, you know, I got a pile like 20. I said, I never felt this good in a long time. It makes me feel good. When I'm making the rose, it's the only relief I get. And I tell my wife, I said, when I'm making these roses, you know, don't bother me. Don't ask me anything like that. Only if it's an emergency, you know, the house is on fire, there's earthquake coming, a tidal wave. Like I said, you could bother me then. But other than that, you know, it's only 2 minutes and, you know, anything else can wait. So it's one of the things that, again, the only relief I get, and nobody else can see it, nobody else hears it, but we can talk about it. But I'm the only one that, for 2 minutes, just don't bother me.
That was Frank Hughes from the organized village of Cake, Alaska. He's told his doctors about his experience, and they say if it works, keep doing it, but they can't explain it. This interview is part of a grant-funded collaborative community reporting project focused on health and wellness in rural Alaska. Find out more about the project and its ethical practices on the web version of this story at alaskapublic.org. Last weekend, a dozen cars, including a four-wheeler, a Vespa, and a utility vehicle, rolled into the Napa Auto Parts store parking lot for Bethel's first car show. And as KYUK's Sunny Bean reports, the gearheads in town got to show off the best of their off-the-road system creativity.
Gary Baldwin prefers to find parts for his 1953 Willys Jeep pickup truck rather than buying them. And it shows when he pops open the hood.
So there's a lot of parts from different vehicles from the dump in here. This air cleaner is out of a Toyota. The cable for the throttle is a Subaru cable. The gas pedal is a Chevy truck.
Baldwin inherited this classic from a former principal in the school district, who would drive it on the local trails when the snow wasn't too deep.
People tell me it was driven to Quinnahawk, and I know it used to be driven back and forth between Unapacheck because he worked in both of those villages.
Baldwin, who is the district superintendent, says he drove it daily until he retired. It takes a lot of work for a car lover to maintain a vehicle in Bethel, and that's a big part of why Zach Huckstep decided to organize the city's first car show. Huckstep showed up with his 1971 Toyota Brown. It's basically a Land Cruiser, and on the morning of the show, he converted its flatbed into a temporary playpen so he could keep his toddler under control while he did some last-minute polishing.
That's an indicator.
Visitors who peeked inside got to see its long leather seats and a perfect Lego replica of the vehicle.
Did I tell you about the Lego garage? So I didn't want to geek out too much, but I actually have like a Lego garage with like all the tools in a garage and a lift and everything for that Lego truck.
That Lego garage is actually the only one Huckstep owns. He doesn't have a life-size one in Bethel. And that's been a problem because Bethel's dust storms can wreck a paint job. And replacement paint, like every other part that makes its way to town, isn't cheap. Neither is getting these vehicles to Bethel.
It was shipped from Australia all the way to, I believe, San Diego. And the funny thing was is that it was actually cheaper to ship from Australia to America than it was to ship from Anchorage to Bethel.
Napa Auto Parts, the only car parts shop in town, welcomed the show. And it was a team effort. Alaska Commercial donated hot dogs and hamburgers. Then Napa employees grilled them for visitors. It wasn't just cars that showed up. There's a brand new four-wheeler, one of the more popular vehicles in the region, and a cherry red Vespa. But Don Roberts brought arguably the most practical vehicle, a new Bobcat. For today's show, he put a 6-foot-long snowblower on the front of it. But Roberts says there's probably 75 different tools he can swap into that spot.
God, there's so many, there's numerous attachments. You can put grass cutters on here, post hole diggers, backhoes will go on it. Anything that will go on a tractor will go on the front of this. I can't name all of them. There's just so many things that will go on this.
But it was Jimmy Gwynn who brought the showstopper, a big, shiny, sun-yellow truck from 1942. He says it was a rare find because most of them were shipped off to war in World War II. He had it shipped up from Seattle. It rarely leaves the garage. It's easy to admire the inside, with its yellow and black stripes and a classic dashboard. But many are struck by how well-maintained it is.
The reason why I like it is because it's, like, almost impossible to keep it clean. I wonder how they even got here without getting it dirty.
It is beautiful. Oh, this is beautiful. Yeah, like a Tonka tour.
And in the end, when all of the votes were counted, Gwynn's truck won best in show.
And so don't run away too far, Jimmy. You also ended up with the People's Choice and first place.
Still, he says the best part of the day was getting to hang out with all the other gearheads in town.
All these cars have just lots of love in them. Doesn't matter if they're beat up or if they're brand new or whatever, that owners really love every one of them. So that's what makes owning a car like this fun, is because everybody cares.
And who knows what wacky cars might roll up next year. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
Well, that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Kavitha George in Anchorage, Rachel Cassandra in Cake, and Sunny Bean in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Annie Fight produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.